All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Meredith and Judge Jaquith. And we're hearing argument today from the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia. They are hosting us and have been wonderful, and we are very pleased to be here. We are hearing the matter of Geraldine B. Lorio versus Dennis McDonough, docket number 22-1323. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
I'm Howard and David.
Thank you, Ms. Donna Howard and Mr. Giza. Thank you, Mr. Morris and Mr. Scruggs. And as you know, each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. How much time would you like to reserve? Okay, we will make that happen. And you may proceed when you're ready, Ms. Donna Howard.
Thank you, Chief Judge Bartley, and may it please the court. When VA finally granted Mrs. Lorio DIC, the retroactive DIC award created an overpayment of SVP annuity. That much is clear. Equally clear is that VA's scheme for dealing with that situation is illegal. Congress has prohibited VA from taking DIC to cover an SVP overpayment. What is more, VA's illegal scheme creates an effective due process free zone in which constitutionally protected DIC is taken without prior notice or a meaningful opportunity to challenge the amount.
Now, Ms. Donna Howard, let's say we agree with you, just for the purposes of this argument, that VA had no legal authority to withhold the portions of the DIC. Wouldn't the proper remedy here be to order VA to release the DIC benefits? And if so, why are you arguing otherwise?
I understand the court's question, Your Honor, and our position is that it is not the appropriate relief here. This court has the ability to fashion appropriate relief under 7252A. Mrs. Lorio's position is that appropriate relief here requires a full and accurate accounting at the agency level before any funds are released. We know from the prior history of this case that numerous mistakes have already occurred in the calculation. Mrs. Lorio does not want an amount released to her before a full and fair accounting to verify that the correct amount of DIC was withheld, because the consequences of that are potentially DOD showing up on her doorstep and demanding that amount back. So the appropriate relief here is to get the accounting and the amount settled first and then release any additional DIC that is still owed to her.
And so Ms. Lovers, the DFAS auditor who did the latest audit, you're not satisfied with that?
No, we're not, Your Honor, because Ms. Lovers' declaration accounts for the gross amount of SVP. We do not have an accounting that accounts for the net post-tax amount of SVP. And so then there is still an open possibility that she was that Mrs. Lorio was effectively taxed on her DIC, which is non-taxable by law, because an amount equal to the pre-tax SBP was withheld instead of the post-tax. So without an accounting that has the net SBP as the figure, we don't know whether she was effectively taxed on the DIC.
And so the Soles notice that you filed in the summer, I believe, that was letting us know that Ms. Lorio received the a check from Treasury. And it said on there, which I have to admit I found kind of odd, it actually told her to, if she had any questions, to talk to the Austin Loan and Accounting Service of VA, the big conglomerate down in Austin that deals with this kind of stuff. So did she ever correspond with them about that check?
We are still awaiting administrative proceedings on the correct, on the accounting that we still only have in partial form. She doesn't have the ability to have a fully informed conversation yet about the amount of that check. What we do know from that check is, as was also stated in the Lauver Declaration, that the initial calculation of the SBP overpayment was wrong. We know that from the fact that she was refunded this approximately $12,000 amount. We know that two mistakes were made. 1 month of SBP was double counted. The premium payments were also not, the legally required refund of the SBP premium payments was not accounted for in the initial calculation. So we know from the check that those two mistakes were made.
She's been corresponding with VA about those errors. Or with both.
Those errors were discovered after this litigation was commenced. That was what got the ball rolling on the steps being taken that she's been asking for years prior to initiating this appeal.
Why does VA have to account for the different tax consequences when taxable survivor benefit plan payments are offset by non-taxable DIC? The Ebert case that the appellant cited was an action against the IRS for a tax refund.
The reason why VA has that responsibility, Your Honor, is that VA took Mrs. Lorio's DIC benefits. So VA had an independent obligation to make sure that the amount that was withheld from her was correct. And that's not a concession that the mechanism and the very taking of the DIC itself was legal. It was not. But now that that has happened, at the very least, there was an independent obligation to ensure that the correct amount was withheld.
Is the withholding by DFAS from SBP payments the measure of any deficiency in DIC payments to Mrs. Lorio?
Sorry, I'm not sure.
The withholding that was apparently done from the SBP payments, is that the measure of the deficiency, or you need a full tax calculation?
We need a full accounting of what the post-tax amount for each month of that retroactive period was. From the Lauver Declaration, we know that what we have now is the gross pre-tax amount. We do not yet have the post-tax amount for that 1994 to 2015 period.
The withholding information would be in DFAS's possession. The tax consequences per payment is going to require the IRS.
The DOD would certainly have the amount that was withheld from each of those monthly SBP annuity payments. And as we know from the correspondence between the two agencies over the past several years, it's something that VA could easily obtain to satisfy its independent obligation to make sure that the correct amount was withheld here.
Can I clarify exactly what relief the appellant is seeking now? Over the course of the proceedings, as we've learned more information, the appellant's suggested relief has changed. So are you saying the full accounting is step one in what you're asking for as relief? Are you no longer asking for the notice under 1450, notice of how to seek a waiver, things of that variety? Is she still seeking that relief?
We are still seeking that relief, but the first step here is the full and accurate accounting. And the reason why is that under DOD's own regulations, a request for a waiver of overpayment is an effective concession of the validity and the amount. So before there can be any intelligent conversation about a waiver of overpayment, the claimant needs to know exactly what was withheld and be able to decide whether to first dispute that.
So as to that question about a waiver, whether there was a potential waiver of the appellant's rights under 5301 and whether we should be talking about pre or post-tax amounts, a lot of the information that the parties have been discussing is not in the record of proceedings before the board. And as you know, our mandate is to review board decisions and to review it based on the record that was before them. So what is your current position on whether the court can or should look at this extra record information? And what would we be reviewing? Because we have no board findings as to pre or post-tax or whether there was a waiver.
I think findings, to take the second question first, I think findings about the amount and the tax are, let's set those aside for the moment as to the extra record evidence question. The extra record evidence at issue here is essentially just the SBP annuity application form. I think the court could take one of two routes here. We would prefer that the court answer all of the legal questions it can before sending this back to the agency. We don't dispute that Mrs. Lorio completed that SBP application, and there's nothing really to dispute about what the form itself says. And we think the court can and should answer the legal question of the waiver of the rights to notice and the waiver of the illegality of the DIC withholding here for either one of two reasons. First, the waiver was void as a matter of it being contrary to legislative policy. 5301 is unambiguous that Congress has placed VA benefits in a special class of protection. They are not subject to offset for this particular debt, and Mrs. Lorio could not validly waive that congressional protection.
So even assuming we agreed with that legal theory, we don't have any board legal or factual conclusions about that 1994 application, that it exists, on what she agreed to, on what the factual or legal ramifications would be of having signed that 1994 application. So that comes back to my original question. Yes. Under 7252, we review decisions of the board, and there's nothing for us to review here. So what, in your view, what would we be reviewing if we're taking this extra record evidence and then drawing our own legal conclusions?
The board did not discuss this application specific to Mrs. Lorio's case, but the board did get into in its decision this notion of a claimant in as a general matter being able to permit this scheme to happen. The board did discuss that because it discussed the DOD regulation that contemplates this alleged waiver mechanism. So the court could certainly review the board's discussion there and hold that it's legally incorrect. That being said, I understand Your Honor's concern about the specific application here not having been part of the record. I think there's not really a disputed issue of fact as to what that form says, but there are regardless a board discussion of that mechanism, and then the court could disagree as a matter of law that is a possible way of granting authority here.
But we would have to, are you saying we could look at that form, but not get into the issue of whether it was a knowing and informed waiver of her rights to challenge the...
Well, I think there are two separate questions about waiver. One is a purely legal question that the waiver is void as a matter of being against legislative policy. That's not a factual question. Alternatively, there's a question of, was the waiver knowing, intelligent, and with full understanding of the consequences? And the court has, in the first instance, made that determination without prior board findings. It did so in Clark v. O'Rourke, and we would ask the court to do so here. This case, as the pleadings show, has been up and down at the board numerous times. Mrs. Lorio asks the court to make all of the legal determinations that can be made before sending this back to the board to ensure that she gets some closure here and the board is set up to make a legally correct decision.
Okay, one other question just about your arguments here. Did you waive any argument with respect to Ms. Lorio's remarriage? And she had argued that she had a common law marriage after age 57. She had argued that below. And I think that might moot the case. I'm assuming you're waiving that argument, but I just wanted some clarification.
That was not part of the pleadings, Your Honor.
Okay, so that argument is out. You're not making that argument.
It was not in the pleadings.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your very diplomatic response.
You've raised factual issues on the knowing and voluntariness question, right? That the situation was coercive and overbearing, Hobson's choice. Aren't those issues that require a fact finder's attention?
As I said, the court has made that determination in the first instance, Your Honor, that a waiver was not knowing and voluntary. It did so in Janssen as well as in Clark, and it could do so here. If the court deems those to be factual issues that need agency to address in the first instance, we would ask for a remand for that. But that's only if the court disagrees with the purely legal argument, which it can decide that there could be no valid waiver here as a matter of law, because Congress has protected DIC from the type of offset that VA is arguing that Mrs. Lorio waived. And that gets to the purpose of SVP, and I think the legislative history behind the plan helps to show that SVP was meant to be sort of a minimum income of last resort for those surviving spouses who either weren't eligible or had not yet received either DIC or Social Security benefits. And once either of those was to kick in, the intent was that would be the primary income stream. Congress even contemplated and discarded the possibility of allowing surviving spouses to make the choice between continuing to receive the SPP and the DIC, and opted in favor of making DIC become the tax-free DIC become that income stream, which I think lends further to support to the argument that Mrs. Lorio could not waive that. It was Congress's intent that become the income stream.
But the arrangement to provide a survivor benefit payment is a contract between the veteran and service. And so how does the application amount to anything more than a this for that contract between the surviving spouse and the service?
Well, Putting myself in the place of a recently bereaved surviving spouse who's applying for this income stream that's meant to provide a minimum source of income. In Mrs. Lorio's case, it was 3 months after her husband's death. She's trying to get that minimum income stream. She's presented with some language about, we're going to theoretically take DIC from you in the future. There's no indication of what notice she might have been otherwise entitled to. I don't see this as a contract, and the application form is also simply not, it's neither legally nor factually a valid waiver of the rights to which she was entitled under the law. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the time.
Thank you, Ms. Donahauer.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Your Honors, what VA did in this case was it helped facilitate an agreement between appellant and the Department of Defense, an agreement that allowed appellant to receive monthly annuity income for over 20 years while her DIC claim was either denied or on appeal. If I may distill the Secretary's position here into 2 points. First, on the issue of authorization, it should not be in dispute that the appellant authorized VA to collect or overpaid or previously paid SBP from her DIC, and the fact that she received SBP for 20 years should alone be dispositive of that. But even accepting her arguments about its validity of that agreement, there's no justiciable controversy here because VA doesn't have the money and appellant is not asking for it back. Second, Your Honor, as the appellant's remaining grievances, these ultimately concern matters over which neither VA nor this court have jurisdiction. But even on the merits of those arguments, Your Honor, they must still fail. Your Honors, I feel that it is critical to emphasize here at the outset that the appellant has been represented by the same counsel since before 2015. And despite 8 years of protests and concerns over how the overpayment or the payments were calculated, the SBP payments were calculated, not once has appellant reached out to DFAS, the entity that administers the SBP program and that paid her the annuity and calculated the amount that was paid. Not once has she asked DFAS for an accounting. Not once has she disputed the overpayment amount with DFAS. And not once has she asked DFAS or the IRS to refund any income tax that she alleges that she was owed or she is owed. Instead, Your Honors.
Is there any evidence that DFAS has reached out to her?
I'm unaware as to whether DFAS reached out to her, but DFAS provided the monthly annuity payments. DFAS provided appellant with annual statements on the amount that was paid, as well as annual tax forms every year. So in that sense, DFAS has continuously advised and paid the appellant and also advised appellant as to how much money was being provided. I'm not aware of any of other communications between DFAS and appellant. But the point here being, Your Honor, is that the appellant is using a VA rating decision on DIC as essentially a proxy to challenge the substantive actions and decisions made by another federal agency, DFAS and the Department of Defense.
Well, isn't that the odd thing about this case, though, is that VA has been telling her, like, we're in charge. Did they ever inform her that she should deal only with DFAS on this issue? I mean, as a matter of fact, I think they've done the exact opposite because, of course, she appealed through the VA system and then a board judge, you know, sent that back to the regional office, sent the findings back to the regional office for some clarification on, in fact, whether this was the correct process that they were using. And the regional office always decided, oh, yes, this we are using the correct process. So she's reading that and even her attorneys are reading that. And VA is basically saying, like, yes, we've done it correctly. You're we did it correctly. The process is fine.
The process being, to the extent that VA was involved, VA withheld an amount of money that DFAS communicated based on the agreement that the appellant entered into with the Department of Defense and DFAS. That was the extent of VA's actions here. And you're right, Your Honors, the board did address some of the substantive arguments, but this stemmed from an appeal by appellants and appellants counsel. Initially, the appeal was arguing that the appellant was entitled to both full amounts of both benefits, which is not correct. And the arguments have changed over time. And you're right, Your Honors, the board did address the substance of some of these arguments, but that doesn't change the fact that this is not a VA action, that VA was not responsible for paying the annuity or calculating the amount of annuity that was paid.
But VA was part of the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding between DOD, this interagency agreement. And so in that sense, it's an involved party.
And the instrument for collection, the agency with whom Mrs. Lorio dealt directly.
The agency with whom Ms. Lorio dealt directly, because she appealed the VA, the favorable DIC rating decision. But as to the memorandum of understanding, that is an agreement between VA and the Department of Defense, but that is not a document that affected appellant's rights. What affected appellant's rights was her application and the authorization contained in that document. The MOU was simply a back-end procedural way between how VA and DOD communicated with each other, given an authorization such as the one that Ms. Lorio signed.
Well, my point is only that she followed this process because it was the process outlined by VA to her, and nowhere did they tell her, look, VA's not involved. Challenge this with DFAS. I don't believe there was any notice. Am I correct?
I do not believe that VA specifically told appellants that she should contact DFAS.
Okay.
It would be our position that's certainly not an obligation on the part of VA to do that. But also, again, appellant received the annuity from DFAS. The check that the appellant received more recently was from the Treasury Department because VA issued it. Everything else came from DFAS. So the appellant certainly should have known who was paying her annuity. This was a DOD annuity, nothing that had to do with VA itself. VA became involved to the extent that it did only when it issued that 2015 decision that granted DIC.
The Secretary's entire argument seems to rest on this application and agreement.
Yes.
So how can we consider the April 1994 application when it wasn't considered in either of the two rating decisions at issue? It wasn't mentioned in any of the four statements of the case or supplemental statements of the case. It wasn't considered in any of the four board decisions by four different veterans law judges. And now we're supposed to serve as fact finders?
No, Your Honor. That's the last question. As to how this court can consider it, there are at least two different independent bases that the court can rely on. The first, Your Honor, is it can presume that this authorization was signed. It was a regulatory requirement, DOD regulations of 1992 that required this authorization to be signed in order for annuity payments to be paid immediately. Because otherwise, the annuity could not be paid until a DIC determination was made. So that was the basis for these authorizations agreements. And it was, and since 1992, it's been a DOD regulatory requirement. So this court can presume that given that the appellant received 20 years of annuity, she signed this authorization. And the court need not rely on any facts there because this is a regulatory presumption created by regulatory duty, which this court recognized in Romero, does not require any evidentiary basis of practice to establish. So the court can presume that this authorization was signed. Second, Your Honors, this court can rely on the Federal Circuit's decision in Eusebio and the doctrine of judicial notice. The Fed Circuit held in Eusebio that the court can consider extra record evidence in furtherance of its review of board or VA decisions, provided that it doesn't make any factual findings in the first instance. No factual findings here are needed. There should not be any reasonable dispute that this document exists, and it was accompanied by an official affidavit as to its receipt. And I don't believe that the appellant is disputing the existence of the document or the fact that she signed it. It contains personal information about the appellants. Your Honor, no evidence needs to be weighed because it's not a matter of probative value of this authorization. It is there or it is not. And there's no factual questions that need to be found because ultimately whether the terms of this document authorize VA to have acted the way that it did is a question of law. So there are ultimately no factual findings that need to be made here. And so Your Honor, to submit under either of those two approaches, this court can consider that authorization.
Counsel.
Yes.
Finish your thought and then I'll-
My thought.
So you're resting entirely on this 1994 application as your authority for what the actions that VA has taken, withholding the appellant's DIC benefits and forwarding them to the Department of Defense. In the board decision, it listed three different possible meanings. 5301B, the appropriations clause, and the memorandum of understanding. Are you conceding that those authorities alone do not give VA the authority to take the actions that they took?
With the exception of the appropriations clause, which is actually part of the underlying basis and the reason and the need for the authorization, Your Honor, it's our position here that these statutes, that they are not what we are relying on here. And Your Honor, it's our position that it's not clear that they provide the authorization. What we have here, though, is an actual express authorization, an authorization that was necessary for her to receive annuity payments in this case for 20 years. Because, Your Honors, and I'd like to stress that absent that authorization, appellant would not have received the minimum income under the SBP for 20 years.
So, as to the memorandum of understanding that two agencies entered into, it mentions that it comes with statutory authorities. Do you have any historical information as to what statutory authorities the two agencies were looking at when they came up with that agreement and thought that it was consistent with law? And do you know of any current statutory provisions that sanction that type of MOU?
I'm not. There's no statutory authority that prohibits this type of engagement between the agencies, nor is there any that prohibits the appellant from entering into the agreement she did with DOD. The statutory basis was the Title 10 statute, 1450C1, that authorizes the SBP, because that statute only authorizes authorized SBP to the extent that it exceeded DIC, which meant that under that statute, that the SBP could not have been paid or would not have been authorized to be paid until a DIC determination was made. The problem is, though, is that SBP decisions can be made very quickly. Beneficiary is identified early on. DIC, however, can take a long time to decide, which would have meant that.
Why?
Because they're far more involved and complex. SBP is essentially an insurance program. So you have a beneficiary, you have a name, and you have someone who is deceased. And it's a set statutory amount, and that's what goes. DIC can involve a lot of questions. In the appellant's case, I believe the initial application was for service connection for the cause of death. That can be a very involved and complicated process. And this was recognized at the time. And it is also true, regardless of whether, whether we want it to be that way or not.
Seems unlikely that the appellant or any reasonable person would expect it would take 22 years to make a determination on this matter.
Oh, in this case.
Or even though, 2 years.
This wasn't 20 years of ongoing litigation. The appellant's DIC was actually denied before she even applied for the SBP. She appealed that denial. The case then lay dormant for years until the appellant, I believe it was 2011, asked to reopen it, and then I think it was 2013 again asked to reopen it. So we're not talking about 20 years of back and forth.
If she appealed the denial, why did she have to ask to reopen it?
Because that appeal stream ended years and years prior. So this case, I believe, it was dormant for a long time before the appellant picked it back up and sought the benefits again, the survivor benefits from VA. And you're right, though, 20 years is a long time. But for those 20 years, the appellant received the SBP, which was the tit for tat of her agreements. Because again, the appellant couldn't have received that, but for authorizing a subsequent collection from her DIC. And the appellant would have been without income for 20 years, undermining and defeating the whole point of SBP, which the appellant recognized is to provide a minimum income to qualified survivors.
Counsel, if we could get back to the memorandum of understanding, it appears that your VA's position is that VA has no obligation to ensure that the amount of money they're withholding from VA benefits and transmitting to the Department of Defense, no authority or obligation to make sure that's the correct amount before you transmit it. Is that your position?
With the exception of ensuring that the amount that we withhold is consistent with the amount that's communicated by the Department of Defense and DFAT, that is correct.
Can you explain why? Because we're not talking about money that Department of Defense is paying out. This is a VA benefit. DIC paid to the survivor of a deceased veteran. Your mission at VA, in part, is to help survivors of veterans. And why would it not be within your mandate to ensure that she gets every dollar of VA benefits to which she's entitled? And here, turns out at least $12,000 were withheld that shouldn't have been.
Because the overpayment amount is calculated by the federal agency that actually provided those payments. They are in the best position to know the amount that was paid. They are in the best position to know.
But don't your employees have access to the DFAS system? It's in your manual, M21-1. It says that some people at the pension center have.
Not to the extent of the numbers that would be involved in a time audit, Your Honor. But what VA is doing, the only decision that VA made in this case was honoring an agreement that the appellant made with DOD. And I'd suggest further, Your Honor, that the secretary here, the secretary didn't make a decision at all on the amount of the overpayment. So there is no secretarial decision here. Beyond that, any decision that VA did make, that the secretary did make, was not made under a law that affects the provision of benefits by VA, which is the impetus to the jurisdiction that then flows from the agency to the board to this court. There was no jurisdiction. And to the extent that the appellant has their grievance concerns the amount that DOD, that DFAS said, was paid to her, both intuitively, but also under the way the law is set up, her grievance should have been directed at that agency. And the appellant here has never so much as attempted to pursue her grievance within that agency or within the statutes that allow relief. So the fact that the appellant is here arguing most of the issues here are not even ripe for consideration because they haven't actually been denied by the agency that can actually provide her with the relief.
But you're giving Judge Meredith the same answer that you gave me a few minutes ago. It basically points out, and I'll make the same comment I made then, this points out how tricky this situation is for Ms. Lorio, because you just said VA made no decision here about the money. And but under the MOU, if she went to DFAS, it's perfectly possible that they would say, look, we have an MOU with VA, and they are taking care of this. So your dispute is with VA.
Over the amount of money, I don't believe that the MOU in any way would discourage the appellant from bringing her grievance about the amounts of the SBP that was paid. The amount that was paid is the amount that translates ultimately into the overpayment. Which I would note in this case, we don't even have an actual overpayment because the amount was collected prior to it actually going to appellant. So, but that amount is calculated and it's under the control of DFAS. The MOU has nothing to do with rights of relief from a party who's aggrieved at something that DFAS did. If DFAS failed to send the appellant checks for the SBP, the appellant would go to DFAS, regardless of what might be said in an MOU. Again, which is simply just the back end procedural way that VA and DOD communicate based on the existence of these authorizations. Here's what VA does, and here's the steps that it does it, and here's how it routes the money back to DOD. But again, doesn't affect the substantive rights of anybody.
So I'll ask you the same question I asked before. Was she ever informed that, yes, this is what VA does, this is what DFAS does? Was there any complete notification of that information?
I am unaware of that. From VA, the answer to that would be no. And Your Honors, and I understand, and you are correct, this is a complicated issue. And the fact that it did take 20 years for appellant ultimately to continue the pursuit and be awarded DIC adds to the complication because it adds to the amount of months in which she was paid SBP. But that does not give this court jurisdiction over the arguments. The fact that this was confusing, that DFAS may have not provided appellant with certain notice that the appellant believes is due, which again, the what DOD regulations or Title 10 statutes might have required of DOD is not at issue here and should not be in front of this court, you know, jurisdictionally. So to the extent that the appellant believes that she's denied some form
of— But how is that true when VA is an instrument of the Department of Defense in the context of this case? And it's VA that withheld the $300,000.
VA withheld the amount of money. And again, the sole decision that VA made was to honor an agreement that the appellant made with DOD. That the appellant made with DOD. And the way it did that was under an agreement.
But what about honoring your VA's notice and meaningful opportunity to contest obligations with respect to claimants for benefits?
To contest decisions made by VA. And again, VA didn't decide the amount of the overpayment. And the appellant, again, Your Honor.
So VA made at least six decisions that we have in the record. Two rating decisions, four board decisions, all by different veterans law judges.
Yes, and respectfully, those were— The original rating decision was a fully favorable DIC determination that granted the appellant's DIC all the way back to the date of the veteran's death. Subsequent to that, the statements of the case and the board's decisions, Your Honor, they were all premised as responses to the arguments that were raised by appellants during the course of the appeal as to, I'm entitled to both benefits in full. No. What was the statute of regulation? You're right, Your Honors. This case might have been resolved, you know, quicker had the veterans law judge understood more about the way that this works. Would have been resolved a lot quicker if the appellants had understood more about the way this worked. That is unfortunate, but again, these unfortunate circumstances don't give rise to jurisdiction within this court to decide a question that should be brought to another federal agency under other federal statutes for which relief is available under those statutes outside of this court.
Well, it wasn't for lack of trying, right? Three successive judges sent it back for more information gathering to figure out the process and how it should function.
In response to the arguments raised, that is correct.
Right? And then at the end of the day, we have a board decision that you ask us to affirm, but reject all the grounds that the board set forth. How do we do that without sending it back to the board?
We're asking the court to affirm because, quite frankly, Your Honor, we don't see that a remand is necessary. If this court believed that there were some factual determinations regarding the authorization that the board needs to decide, Your Honors, the secretary, again, believes it's not necessary, but would not put up a fight against that. The critical issue for the secretary here, though, is the scope of sending anything back, which is, again, nothing should be sent back to the secretary for the secretary to adjudicate a matter over which it has no jurisdiction, which again is the amount of the SPP. And while appellant may not have known it then, appellant certainly knows now that she can bring she could have brought these grievances to DFAS. She could have asked DFAS for an accounting. To the extent that the appellant again believes that there are tax consequences to what happened here, appellant's recourse is ultimately with the IRS or within a claim against the government, but that is, again, outside of Title 38, and that's outside of the jurisdiction of this court. In fact, Your Honor, the cases that were cited, and even going back as far as the Strickland case, the Fourth Circuit case, I think it was 1974, they've recognized, right, the kind of the retroactivity of, between VA disability compensation and in that case, I think it was military retired pay, right? So there is precedent. It's simply not precedent in this court because they're not matters that concern this court. The question is whether those SPP benefits turn into tax-free benefits to which the appellant may have a claim with the IRS for getting back the taxes that have been paid. But again, that does not concern any action to the secretary or any issues with respect to her actual DIC. These are avenues for relief that the appellant simply never attempted to pursue. So to the extent that they're being brought here, they're both jurisdictionally misplaced, but also they're not ripe because the appellant has never requested, let alone been denied, that type of relief, any recovery of any income tax that she believes that she's owed. These are premature arguments.
As to the relief that VA is seeking, you just suggested that we affirm the decision, but in part, the board found that the amount of the debt was correctly calculated. And at the time, VA thought the debt was $302,000. Now it's down to about $290,000. what is it you think we should do with that finding? How could we possibly leave that intact?
To the extent that the court leaves it intact, it's a non-binding finding. It has no bearing on DOD's assessment of the calculation of the amount. This court could simply cross out that part of the board's decision. In fact, cross out most of the board's decision and find ultimately that the arguments that are raised here outside of the authority question are beyond the scope of the jurisdiction. And there is precedent for the court simply vacating or change, just removing a portion of the board's decision to avoid any potential future conflict. But again, that should have no impact because VA is not the decider of what the appellants
If we were to conclude that the new information that's come to light during the course of this appeal, the 1994 application, various calculations that were made, we can't consider in the first instance, what is it you're suggesting that we would instruct the board to do on remand?
I don't believe there's anything for the board to do. This court has the authority to, again, either presume that an authorization was signed, and it was, because again, we have a regulation that required it, or alternatively, to consider under UZBA and doctrine of judicial notice, the existence of this document and the authorization. Beyond that, beyond whether VA was authorized to undertake this collection, there's nothing else for VA to consider. So there should be no, that's why there should be no remand here. There's nothing to instruct the board, unless again, the court believes that there is some fundamental finding of fact that the board needs to make with respect to the authorization that is not otherwise a question of law. And I'd note on that point of authorization, again, it is pretty clear on its face, but there's nothing that the appellant can do as a factual matter to challenge that. Because we're in a law school, I will mention the parole evidence rule. And there is no ambiguity in this authorization. The authorization is 100% clear in explaining to appellant that she cannot receive the full SBP and DIC benefit. It is 100% clear that she is only entitled to the amount of SBP that exceeds her DIC. It is 100% clear in telling her that what she's doing by signing is authorizing VA to collect paid SBP from her DIC. So there's no evidence that the appellant can introduce as to what she may or may not have understood that agreement to contemplate. So this is a purely legal question at the end of the day that this court can resolve here. And that is assuming that the appellant is continuing to contest it. I will, on that note, though, like to highlight one point here, which is in response to the appellant has referred to this as a waiver, Your Honor. Don't believe that's a fair characterization. This wasn't a waiver. This wasn't one party simply relinquishing rights. This was an appellant elected to receive SBP now in exchange for a future collection from DIC later. This was a trade-off which had benefits at a cost. Those benefits, appellant reaped for 20 years. And after receiving those benefits for 20 years, it suggests now that there is some invalidity, invalidness, there's something wrong with that authorization, Your Honor. That it seems 20 years too late to challenge that at this point, because again, she's received that benefit.
So whether you call this a waiver or an election, as you want to characterize it, isn't there still a question of whether it was knowing and informed? I mean, we have a lot of case law, none of which is coming to mind immediately, but I know there is case law out there that we have and the other courts have about, yes, whenever someone, an appellant, agrees to certain language and they sign it, there's tons of cases about, did they know what they were doing when they signed it? Was it informed? Were they aware of all the repercussions?
Those cases typically address waivers, which is simply the relinquishment of a right, not a mutual exchange, not an exchange of a benefit in exchange for something else. In those cases, I don't believe that the waiver analysis typically does apply.
Well, if you want to, if you want to make the point that it's really an election and not a waiver, we have the Rudisill case up at the Supreme Court right now. And the veteran in that case elected a certain trade-off of education benefits, and that is under contention.
Your Honor, but we need not even rely. That was simply just highlighting the fact that this was a trade-off. An election, the same way that an election claimant under the AMA may elect board review rather than HLR review. We don't engage in that knowing, voluntary, and intelligent discussion in every single case where there's an appeal only that gets court. But even if we apply the waiver analysis, the knowing, voluntarily, and intelligent, it was, Your Honor, it was in writing, signed in front of witnesses. It adhered to the regulatory scheme that existed since 1992 and the regulatory requirements. It explained clearly again that SBP would be established in full, but that full benefits of both DIC and SBP couldn't be got, and that SBP could only be received to the extent that it exceeded.
You're making statements that sound like they're purely legal, but they're not. You just said that the language clearly stated. That in itself is subject to a factual finding about whether the language was clear.
I'm not sure that it's subject to a factual finding. I do believe that, again, that the waiver analysis is a legal question for the court to answer. And as far as my reference to clarity, Your Honor, I mean, I believe that this court can read the language that is in the waiver. And I believe that what I said is consistent with that language. I don't believe that there's any room for interpretation. So again, even if this waiver analysis was applied, which I do believe this court can do in the first instance, all the components of it, the knowing, intelligent, voluntary, were met, and we look at it based on the four corners of that agreement and at the time that it was made, not in hindsight 20 years after the benefit of that agreement was received. Your Honor, I see my time is expiring.
We can also see on the annuity application that it contains none of the elements of required notice required either of defense or of VA from 5301 and 2 on VA's part or 1450 on defense's part. None of that's present in that.
Let's add one additional minute.
Annuity application.
Your Honors, again, to the extent that there's a grievance as to whether DOD provided sufficient notice, that's a grievance that should be taken up with DOD within the federal appeal stream that would stem from DOD, not going to this court. To the extent, though, that the appellant has argued that the notice provisions of 1450C3 apply, they don't they don't apply to VA, Secretary of VA, but they also don't apply in this particular case because that concerns recoveries from future payments, but also there was no actual overpayment here because the offset occurred simultaneous with the award itself. So this was a solution that benefited appellants who received the benefit of this agreement for 20 years. And to the extent that the appellant has continuing grievances with the amounts that DOD communicated to VA, that grievance should be taken up with DFAS and through the appropriate statutory appeals processes available there.
Thank you, Mr. Morris.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Donahower, you may move ahead with rebuttal.
I'd like to start by reminding us all that Mr. Lorio paid for his surviving spouse to have a minimum income stream after his death, period. There was no trade-off involved for Mrs. Lorio to be eligible to receive that SBP. She did not need to agree to give up anything in the future to be entitled to the minimum income stream that Congress created and her husband paid for. So the very premise of the argument that there was some trade-off involved in that form, that she could only receive that SBP if she agreed to something in the future, is simply false, just looking at the text of the SBP structure. That being said, the issue here is not complicated, it is simple. There's a marriage of convenience here between the two agencies. They cannot have it both ways, such that the agency who is taking the money from Mrs. Lorio is magically not the agency who is bound by any of the legal constraints on how to do that. And that is even setting aside the fact that taking that DIC from her was illegal in the first place. Just to touch briefly on the tax matter, which wasn't discussed in the principal argument, She cannot ask the IRS for relief. The time to do so had already passed for most of the years that she had received SBP by the time that VA finally awarded the retroactive DIC payment when it discovered the clear and unmistakable error in its prior decision. The appropriations clause seemed to me to be the only legal authority that the board relied on that opposing counsel defended here. And the appropriations clause doesn't mean that you can take a statutorily protected benefit or recoup an overpayment to the government by whatever means necessary. There are statutory guardrails on that. There may be money that needs to be recouped, but there's a process for doing so that needs to be followed. And on a related point to Judge Meredith's question, I also saw that language in the MOU purporting to invoke some kind of consistency with statutes and regulations, and I could not find anything that actually authorizes, let alone doesn't prohibit, what DOD and VA purport to do in that MOU. And to Judge Bartley's question also about where is the remedy here, that goes back to this sort of game of not it that's happening here. VA has informed Mrs. Lorio that they are the agency who took her money, that they are the agency in which to have the dispute over what the legal authority or lack thereof for doing that was. And as opposing counsel also admitted, VA was the agency who paid her $12,000 this past summer. So it just cannot be that her remedy lies elsewhere. A VA benefit was taken from her against the law. And at the very least, now that that has happened, it needs to have been done so in the correct amount. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Donna Hauer. And the court wants to thank both parties for arguments. The case is submitted for consideration. Before we adjourn, I do again want to thank the Appalachian School of Law and the Dean of the Law School, DJ Western, for all of the work on this. Dean James, who is the Dean of Students, and Ms. Patty Lester, who, as you all know, is involved in student affairs. And I also want to thank all the students for being such a great audience. Court is now adjourned.
All right.